On this week's 51%, we speak with the president of Planned Parenthood about how the big, beautiful bill in Congress could impact the organization's clinics.
So many patients would be limited in their access to birth control, to STI testing and treatment, to breast cancer screenings and wellness exams.
We also debunk some menopause myths and speak with the hosts of a new NPR podcast highlighting how women have helped each other access abortion despite restrictions. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. June 24th marked the third anniversary of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, the Supreme Court case that overturned Roe v. Wade. Since then, we've seen nearly half the country place more restrictions on abortion, and 13 states currently ban it. Now, Planned Parenthood, the nonprofit health organization that, yes, provides abortion, warns President Trump's big, beautiful budget bill in Congress could restrict abortion access even more, even in states where abortion is legal. Already, federal law prevents Medicaid from paying for abortions. That's not new. Planned Parenthood does more than abortions. Its clinic served more than 2 million patients last year for everything from STD testing and birth control to mental health. But the bill would prohibit any Medicaid reimbursement at all to nonprofits that received more than $800,000 in federal funds in 2023 and that are, quote, primarily engaged in family planning services, reproductive health, and related medical care, end quote. Planned Parenthood President Alexis McGill Johnson says that effectively singles them out. Now, at the time this episode was recorded, that bill hasn't been finalized yet. It's in the Senate, with Republicans trying to pass it through a complicated process called reconciliation that would allow them to avoid a Democratic filibuster. But also, just before this taping, the Supreme Court decided to uphold a South Carolina law barring Planned Parenthood from Medicaid, allowing other states to do the same. With some offices already struggling financially, Johnson says the Big Beautiful bill could cause nearly 200 of its clinics to close.
It would mean that nearly 200 Planned Parenthood health centers in about 24 states would be at risk of closure, and more than 90% of those health centers, those closures, would be in states where abortion is actually protected and legal. So in many ways, not only would the impact of this bill passing mean that, you know, so many patients would be limited in their access to birth control, to STI testing and treatment, to breast cancer screenings and wellness exams. It would also mean that in those states where abortion is legal, that there would be fewer appointments available, there would be fewer providers available, and that would impact, again, the ongoing public health crisis as it relates to the world post-Dobbs.
You mentioned, I think you said, 24 states, and not all of them currently restrict abortion. Tell me more about the locations here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that when you look at how the states that have been able to take advantage of Medicaid as a broad insurer in their communities, many of those states are states that have expanded access to healthcare under the Affordable Care Act. There are many of the states that really prioritize ensuring that their constituents have a broad, wide-ranging access to care across the board. So that's going to be, you know, states like California and New York and Illinois and Michigan. And, you know, and while there is Medicaid access all across the country in many states, it does feel that in particular, the way this provision is designed is to really go after the Planned Parenthoods that are in states with abortion access.
Well, obviously, as you noted, you know, Planned Parenthood does more than just abortions. How would these closures impact your patients?
Well, look, I mean, we're already in a precarious time, right? You know, healthcare in general is in a precarious time. We have been at minimum since since COVID, and then you layer on the Dobbs decision, and then you layer on these attacks on Medicaid defunding, and we have obviously a lot of services that Planned Parenthood provides. When you start to take away health centers and the provision of care, it means that people may delay their care longer or seeking access to care until they can travel longer distances in order to get that. It may mean that they may not forgo all care altogether, right? And so, we have like a state like Georgia, for example, which has, about only half of the counties in Georgia have an OBGYN. And Planned Parenthood sits kind of at the intersection of being able to fill the gaps inside of a broken healthcare system, and you start to chip away at access and their ability to use their insurance to pay for that care, and you will see increases in things like the maternal mortality rate. You will see increases in STI rates. You will see increases in HIV rates because people are going to delay or be prevented from getting the care that they need.
I mean, from your perspective, what is the outlook? Does Planned Parenthood have options to oppose the loss in funding going forward?
Well, right now the bill is in the Senate. And so it's important right now that while we feel that obviously so much is happening, that the power is still with the people. And we know that the majority of Americans do not want to see Trump or Congress take away funding for birth control or take away funding for cancer screenings or STI testing. And they really don't want politicians to be involved in personal medical decisions like abortion. So the way you let them know that is by calling them, by writing them, by sending them emails. These are things that lawmakers pay attention to. How loud is their constituency as it relates to an issue? Because it knows it helps them understand the impact of how they will be held accountable when they take a vote. So calling your US senator, demanding that they vote no on the budget reconciliation bill that defunds Planned Parenthood, telling them that you are opposed to the deep cuts in Medicaid that could impact rural hospitals, it could impact the number of residents and providers that are trained on Medicaid, that could impact the benefits that low-income children need just to get a decent meal at school. All of the things that are under attack that really help keep communities whole and safe. Any kind of attacks on those items, people need to let their senators know that that's not acceptable, that they cannot do that in their name as a constituent, and that they urge them to vote no.
From your view, has, I guess, the country's abortion debate or the landscape around it changed in the months since President Trump returned to office?
I don't know that the debate has changed. I think that the consolidation of power has changed. Abortion has actually been quite a uniting factor among the majority of Americans, as we have seen in ballot initiative after ballot initiative. When people are allowed to vote directly on whether or not they want to preserve or even expand abortion access, they overwhelmingly vote in support of securing their reproductive freedom. What has changed over the years has been a capture and consolidation of power of state houses and judges by anti-abortion politicians and jurists. And in that regard, again, it requires the people to stay vigilant to ensure that they are voting and holding these electeds accountable for the decisions that they are making that are completely counter to where the people sit. So, I see an expansion of abortion public opinion in many ways. I see a broader understanding of how abortion bans have made pregnancy more dangerous, and a greater understanding of the abortion care that is needed in miscarriage management. And I think people are connecting the dots on the fact that we are at much greater risk with fewer rights, and that we need our elected officials to stand a lot stronger in defending our rights and freedoms.
Alexis McGill-Johnson is the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood. You can learn more about Planned Parenthood services at plannedparenthood.org. As some studies have shown, restricting legal abortion does not necessarily result in less abortions. Instead, many women are forced to pursue abortions in secret, and that can be really dangerous, depending on the method one chooses. But as a new podcast from NPR's Embedded highlights, women have a long history of helping each other out.
It was spreading by word of mouth.
I was like, what? No way!
A huge discovery.
Women stopped dying.
The Network tells the story of how a loose web of women discovered a safe way to have medicated abortions outside of clinics and how they spread the word while staying under the radar. Co-hosts and reporters Victoria Estrada and Marta Martinez focused heavily on women in Latin and South America, where abortion is still largely restricted. But they say this kind of underground passing of knowledge happens all over the world and has been happening for decades.
This is a story that we have been wanting to tell for several years at this point. Both Victoria and I have worked covering reproductive rights in the Americas for many years now. And in Latin America, there's this pill that is very well known and it's used for abortions outside of the medical setting. And then when Roe fell, or when Roe was overturned in 2022 and women lost access to clinics in the United States, we thought this is a really important story to tell right now and to put it into context, because this is a reality that women in Latin America have been facing for decades at this point.
I guess this is a little bit of a spoiler alert, but this kind of becomes the story of misoprostol, the pill that, you know, in the U.S. anyway, is typically taken with mifepristone during medicated abortions. But it is possible to use it without mifepristone and still have an abortion.
Yeah, I think that misoprostol is a pill that was originally intended to treat ulcers. And this is, it's a pill that's been around like since the 1970s. And when it arrived in Brazil in the mid-1980s, it took on a new life because women there, they were living under very restrictive abortion laws. They didn't have much access to doctors. And so they were doing other methods, to very unsafe methods, to end their own pregnancies. And once misoprostol came into the market, they just started using it and found that this is a very safe way to have a method. And what our series follows is, yes, the movement on the ground with women. We talk with doctors, activists, women who use the pill in those very early years, and then we go and follow it throughout the decades. But what is very, very interesting is that eventually what these women discovered was studied and backed by science, and now it's a method that is recommended by the World Health Organization as a safe abortion method.
So how did this loosely connected network for women work? You know, like, how are women passing around their knowledge of misoprostol, and were there any methods that I guess surprised you during your reporting?
So many things. I would say every single episode has been such a discovery in terms of how women were so organized and were very resourceful and creative in contexts that were legally very restrictive. And what's important to also highlight about the story is that these were poor women. These were women of color who experimented on their own with this pill, and they took risks on their lives and legally as well. And one of the things that really stuck with me is how once they knew about this pill, they spread the knowledge in the most basic ways. For example, you know, in Argentina, they started organizing and they had a helpline, and they just used like a very old, like tiny Nokia phone, and they would pass it from one volunteer to the next. And that's how they were actually letting other people know and answering women's questions about how to have an abortion. So with very little resources, right? Like Brazilian women in Brazil going to the pharmacy and buying miso at the pharmacy and trying it out, to picking up a very basic cell phone to actually answer the questions of women every day.
Medicated abortions account for a majority of abortions in the U.S. And here, mifepristone gets a lot of the attention and lately a lot of the attacks. You know, there have been attempts to rescind the FDA's approval for mifepristone despite it being safe. Why doesn't misoprostol get the same attention and scrutiny that mifepristone does here?
I think that that's a very interesting question. It's something that Marta and I also noted, like in our reporting, is something that pushed our reporting that we did see like the pills becoming more relevant and also like a battleground. And so we wanted to dig deeper into it. And I think that, as we said, like the origins of misoprostol, like in this double life, that in the US it's actually approved for ulcers. Like it's only approved for abortions in conjunction with mifepristone. And so I think that the fact that it has this very specific history that we tell in the series, I think that it's very important. Like we were very interested in going back and reconstructing where it comes from, who, like, how did it travel? Who were the people who pushed for it? How did it get like more validated? Just so you can understand like what is happening now in the US, because as you're saying, it's correct. I think that mifepristone, since it's a pill that was developed specifically for abortions, it has a different life than misoprostol. And so I think that we just wanted to tell that story that specific, as Marta also said, like in the US, it's less known. I think that our background, like covering Latin America, it's the most popular pill. Like some research estimates that it's the most popular pill used for abortions in the world, but that's not the case in the US. And so I think we thought it was very interesting to try to document that and see what was happening now that there's a lot of changing abortion. The landscape around abortion is very changing now in the US.
Yeah, I guess, you know, on that note, how does the changing landscape for abortion rights in the U.S. impact abortion rights in other countries or even, I guess, vice versa? You know, how do we impact each other here? Do we?
That's definitely something we've been trying to document in the series, which is this global, loosely connected nodes of the network. And there are nodes of the network in the United States, too. And they are growing very fast, especially since Roe was overturned. There was such a huge spike in demand for abortion pills. And today, actually, a lot of people don't know this, but the majority of abortions that are happening in the United States are abortions with pills. So it is a reality. It is a need that has been growing since abortion restrictions have been passed more and more in several states in the United States. So this is something that more women are using, and we are just trying to make that connection of, actually, this is not something new. This is something that has been happening in other parts of the world for decades. And all this knowledge that the women built in Latin America over 40 years is now being shared in the United States. And we actually have specific examples of parts of the network in Latin America, in Mexico, for example, training groups in the United States who are doing similar things of what they were doing in Mexico and are still doing decades ago.
Well, Victoria and Marta, thanks so much for taking the time. Tell me a little bit more about what reporting this podcast was like and how you decided to tell this story.
The series is a narrative series, so we have a lot of stories. And so I think that we're hearing from different people from four decades. And so we want people to really be like, we tried to make this series as engaging as possible. And I think you're going to hear something that is very surprising. It's, you're going to like peek into a world that you didn't know existed. And I think that that's what we most wanted with the series, just to like bring this like hidden known part of history, like to the general public.
We were counting the other day and we have spoken to nearly 100 people to make this series. So, and all over the world, pretty much, especially across the Americas. So it was a big effort to kind of try to have a clear narrative thread, right? From the 1980s to the United States today. And we're hoping that this series helps have better information and understand better a reality that has become more relevant for the United States today.
Victoria Estrada and Marta Martinez are the co-hosts of NPR's embedded podcast, The Network. You can listen at npr.org or wherever you find your podcasts. Victoria and Marta, thanks again.
Thank you, Jesse.
We're going to switch gears now to talk about a major but little talked about topic, menopause. It's something all women have to go through eventually, and it involves some pretty major changes for the body, for our health. So why do we still know so little about it? And what we do, quote unquote, know isn't always accurate. Dr. Joanne Manson is on a mission to debunk some menopause myths. Manson is the chief of the Division of Preventative Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, and a professor of medicine and women's health at Harvard Medical School. She's a former president of the North American Menopause Society, and she's done extensive research on epidemiology and risk factors for chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease and cancer. I recently sat down with Manson to get some quick menopause facts.
Menopause is defined as the end of menstrual periods, usually requires 12 months without a menstrual period in order to know that menopause has occurred. Menopause also means the end of reproductive potential. In contrast to perimenopause, which is a transitional phase leading into menopause, can last 5 years or even 10 years or longer, where the menstrual cycles become irregular. There are major fluctuations in hormone levels like estrogen, progesterone, but they're fluctuating up and down, and there isn't the really abrupt decline. And women do intermittently ovulate. So an important point is that during the perimenopause, which in some women is occurring in early 40s, mid 40s, women can still become pregnant. There are some unintended pregnancies that are occurring during those ages because women think that if their menstrual periods are very irregular, that they're no longer ovulating, but they can intermittently ovulate. Now, the symptoms of hot flashes, night sweats, these hallmark symptoms of menopause can occur during perimenopause when the cycles are just irregular and when the hormone levels are fluctuating, but very often they can last well into the menopause, an average duration of 7 to 8 years, actually, for hot flashes, night sweats, and those hallmark symptoms of menopause.
How does this change impact your body as a whole? You know, not only are you just not menstruating anymore, but how does this impact the other parts of your body?
So in addition to hot flashes and night sweats, there can be disrupted sleep. I mean, this is strongly related to night sweats, and that can cause its own set of problems, such as difficulty concentrating, brain fog, mood swings. Some women will experience joint pain, palpitations. So there's really a wide range of symptoms that can occur. In addition, just physiologically, there are changes going on with these fluctuating hormones and then the rather dramatic reduction in estrogen occurring at menopause. There are changes such as change in the fat distribution so that there's more fat mass in the abdominal area. That has been linked to an increased risk of diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol. So women, it's important that women understand that there may be these physical changes in the body, especially in terms of the change in the distribution of body fat. It may not reflect itself as a gain in weight on the scale, but they are likely to notice the change in body fat distribution. This is again linked to some changes in risk factors, such as increased blood pressure, increase in the LDL cholesterol, some decline in the HDL, the protective HDL cholesterol, and also an increase in glucose that may be linked to an increase in risk of type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome conditions, as they're often called. So there are some health implications of the physiologic changes that occur during menopause. It's important that women understand this because it is the menopause marks a time when the risks of many chronic diseases will increase, including heart disease, stroke, cognitive decline, certain forms of cancer. But there's a lot that we can do to lower our risk. And this is, you know, a time to become even more vigilant about healthy lifestyle, healthy diet, regular physical activity, strength training to protect the bones, because there's also some loss in bone mineral density. So there's a lot that we can do, but it's also very important that women who, for example, would benefit from medications to treat the cholesterol changes or the blood pressure changes, it's really important that they get adequate treatment, because that's an area where women have tended to lag behind men in terms of getting the recommended treatment for cardiovascular risk factors.
Around this time, is it recommended that people get more frequent doctor visits? How often should people be checking up on these kinds of things?
I think there's no need to go more often than once a year if they're relatively free of, you know, these chronic conditions. Once they have a diagnosis of, let's say, hypertension, diabetes, they'll have more frequent visits that are recommended. However, if a woman is having bothersome symptoms, hot flashes, night sweats, moderate to severe symptoms, it's important that she seek attention for those symptoms, because there are many treatment options available. There's estrogen therapy, menopausal hormone therapy. There are non-hormonal options for her. Again, you know, these symptoms can disrupt sleep and can have a lot of health consequences related to disrupted sleep and the impaired, you know, quality of life. So if she has significant symptoms, you know, seek treatment, explore the different options available, keep up with regular healthcare visits. And if a healthcare condition is diagnosed, such as hypertension, abnormal cholesterol, diabetes, then more frequent visits may be recommended.
Okay. You mentioned estrogen and hormone therapy as a treatment. I know that there are some people who are hesitant to go ahead with hormone therapy. So I just want to clarify here, you know, like, how safe is hormone therapy, and how do you know if it's a good idea for you?
Well, the research suggests that women who are younger, who are earlier in menopause, such as below the age of 60 or within 10 years of onset of menopause, do have a more favorable benefit risk profile from hormone therapy than women who are older and more distant from menopause. So age is an important factor. Many women are still very appropriate candidates for hormone therapy if they're early in menopause and they have bothersome moderate to severe symptoms. The benefits are likely to outweigh the risks, and these hormones are very effective in treating the bothersome hot flashes and night sweats. However, there are non-hormonal options as well. And there are some other hormonal options that may be safer than what was seen in the Women's Health Initiative. So in terms of other hormonal options, we have lower doses now than were tested in the WHI. We also have the patch estrogen given through the skin, as opposed to the kind given as a pill, which goes directly through the liver and can increase risk of blood clots. So the lower doses and transdermal patch estrogen appears, based on available research, to be somewhat safer than the pill form. And then we have non-hormonal options, such as antidepressants, gabapentin, and a new class of non-hormonal treatment that works in the brain to, in terms of temperature regulation, fezolinetant, which is another very good option for women who are not candidates for estrogen therapy or want to avoid any hormonal therapy.
All right. Well, I guess, what do you feel people most commonly misunderstand about menopause and perimenopause?
Well, I think very importantly, there's no one size fits all answer. It's very different in terms of experiences that women have. Some women have very minimal short-term symptoms. Other women have very prolonged, bothersome, moderate to severe symptoms. Another myth is that these symptoms are always very short-term. They pass within just a year or two, or even a couple months. So just, you know, tough it out. In reality, the average duration is 7 to 8 years, in some women more than a decade. Another myth is that women go very rapidly into menopause. You know, they have regular menstrual periods until they're suddenly in menopause. It does not happen overnight. there is a phase of life called perimenopause that can last easily 5 years, even up to 10 years, where the menstrual cycles become irregular, where hormone levels are fluctuating, where women may even begin to have some of these symptoms, and then of hot flashes, night sweats, and then gradually they lose ovulation and the hormone levels decrease more dramatically, and they go through menopause, which again is defined as a full year without a menstrual cycle, and you know, the ovulation is no longer taking place.
Dr. Joanne Manson is the chief of the Division of Preventative Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor of medicine and women's health at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Manson, thanks for joining us today.
Good to meet you.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half. He was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.